From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I was turned away at the border.
The globalization of security. Activists are being turned back from the Canadian border as they begin protesting April's economic summit in Quebec, the FTAA, Free Trade Agreement of the Americas. Also, campaign finance reform Senate style. The Senate adds another loophole to McCain-Feingold. Candidates facing self-financed opponents will be able to circumvent limits on individual contributions. And the color of money. If you can't pay, you don't play. We'll look at campaign contributions and race. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Mexican President Vicente Fox appealed to Zapatista rebels to stay in Mexico City and negotiate with Congress over his proposed Indian rights bill. Fox said he would meet rebels' demands to close three more military bases near their jungle headquarters and free more Zapatista prisoners. He asked Congress to meet with rebel leaders quickly to discuss the Indian rights legislation. Lori Berenson blew her parents a kiss and managed a smile before she was led out of the courtroom at Lima's San Juan de Lurigancho prison as the first day of her civilian retrial on terrorism charges ends. The 31-year-old New York native again proclaimed her innocence yesterday against charges that she collaborated with the Peruvian rebel group, the MRTA. A secret military court convicted Berenson of treason in 1996 and sentenced her to life in prison for being a leader of the rebel group. Peru's highest court overturned the conviction, leading to the new civilian trial in which Berenson faces the lesser charge of terrorist collaboration. I'm innocent of all the charges made against me, Berenson said. She spoke while standing in a concrete cell behind steel bars, a common arrangement for terrorism trials in Peru. She said, "The fact you have me behind bars violates the principle of a presumption of innocence." Berenson's parents watched from the first row of the gallery jammed with reporters and curious onlookers. Her supporters argued the new trial should not proceed since it constitutes double jeopardy in antiquated terrorist courts, which the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights has labeled repressive and unfair. The three-judge panel suspended the trial until Thursday to give Lori Berenson a chance to consider a confession, which could lead to a reduced sentence. The prosecution seeks 20 years. Her father, Mark Berenson, told reporters, "Lori has nothing to confess. She is innocent. Innocent people don't confess." And this news from Macedonia. The Macedonian government has given the ethnic Albanian militias that are occupying villages in the north of the country 24 hours to halt their attacks and leave Macedonia. The government says that if the militias don't leave, it'll begin heavy bombing at midnight local time. We now turn to Democracy Now! Correspondent Jeremy Scahill in Belgrade for the latest.
For six straight days, Macedonian security forces have been battling the armed Albanian militias in the northern town of Tetovo. Now, the government in Skopje says it has had enough. Late last night, Macedonia said it was beginning a unilateral ceasefire with the armed Albanians, who call themselves the National Liberation Army. If the Albanians do not withdraw from Macedonia by midnight tonight, the government says it will begin a heavy bombardment. A joint statement issued by the Interior and Defense Departments in Macedonia late last night said the country's security forces will continue using all means, quote, against the positions of terrorists until they are completely destroyed. Well, just a few minutes ago, Macedonia's Foreign Minister Sergen Karim addressed reporters in the capital Skopje. Here's what he said.
Jeremy, can you explain what he's saying? It's too soft for us to hear.
Macedonia's Foreign Minister Sergen Karim is saying that the most important point from the government's perspective there is that this is a ceasefire that has been called by the Macedonian government. If the Albanian rebels do not leave the north of Macedonia, he says that any sovereign country would have the right to then take the military action that they have promised against these rebels. Now, as he was saying that, hundreds of Macedonians have begun fleeing from this northern area, and there is no indication that the Albanian rebels are going to leave. So it appears imminent that there is going to be a heavy bombardment of these ethnic Albanian militants in the north of Macedonia. This could indeed careen the region into yet another Balkan war. Amy, back to you.
Jeremy Scahill reporting to us from Belgrade, Democracy Now! Correspondent. And now we go down to Brazil, where the sight of the world's biggest oil platform sinking off Brazil's coast yesterday brought tears and anger from those who'd held on to a slim hope that they would be able to bury 9 missing loved ones listed as dead. Relatives watched as TV images showed state oil company Petrobras' 40-story high rig disappear beneath the waves after a frantic but ultimately fruitless fight to keep it afloat after devastating explosions last Thursday. The rig sank yesterday with 312,000 gallons of diesel fuel aboard and 78,000 gallons of crude. The Brazilian firm that owns the rig has been embarrassed by a series of environmental disasters. Last year alone, there were 3 big spills, including one in Rio de Janeiro's picturesque Guanabara Bay in January.
Love you made me pay an awful price. I tried to gamble with you, but you were using crooked dice. Somebody's gotta suffer, somebody's gotta feel some pain. If it's gonna rain down misery, why it's all gotta fall on me. If it's gonna rain down misery, why it's all gotta fall on me.
Love, life, and money. Marianne Faithful here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Well, the Senate continued its debate on campaign finance reform yesterday and passed the first amendment to the legislation in question, the McCain-Feingold bill. Supporters claim that the amendment, approved by 70-30, would protect candidates from being swamped by even wealthier candidates who finance their own campaigns. Instead of placing limits on the amount these super-rich candidates can spend, however, the amendment would lift the contribution limits for their opponents. The current $1,000 limit on contributions from individuals would be raised in 2 steps, to $3,000 and then to $6,000. Senator Mike DeWine, a Republican from Ohio who helped negotiate the amendment, said, quote, "We're going to level the playing field. We're going to say this is not a system that's open to the highest bidder." He added that the current situation is ludicrous because it limits everyone to contributions of $1,000 except a rich candidate who, under Supreme Court rulings, can put unlimited amounts of personal cash into the campaign. But even as many Democrats were voting for the proposal, Minority Leader Thomas Daschle, the Democrat from South Dakota, and several other Democratic leaders protested that higher contribution limits would increase the influence of big givers and flew in the face of the McCain-Feingold bill. The original bill would ban unlimited soft money contributions to political parties and crack down on issue ads by independent groups that target candidates just before an election. We're joined by several people. Let's begin with Susan Anderson, who's Washington Director of Public Campaign and co-author of the study, The Color of Money. Your response to this McCain-Feingold amendment that was passed yesterday.
Oh, thank you, Amy. Thanks for having us on this morning. Yes, I mean, I think that many of us who have followed and have been an active part of the campaign finance reform debate over the years are completely dismayed about the incumbent protection amendment that was passed yesterday. This Domenici-DeWine amendment that you so well explained just a little bit ago is really a bill to protect millionaires from billionaires. It is not a bill to transform running for office, and nor does it level the playing field, as Senator DeWine so claimed that it would. If you are already able as an incumbent to raise large contributions from wealthy interest, you're simply now going to be able to raise larger contributions from wealthy interest. And this does not at all level the playing field that would occur under a public finance system, which would be far more equitable in its implementation.
Stephanie Wilson is also with us from Kalamazoo, Michigan, Executive Director of the Fannie Lou Hamer Project. What is your reaction to this amendment?
Well, on behalf of the Samuel Hamer Project, the DeWine Amendment is absolutely unacceptable. We can no longer support the McCain-Feingold bill as it's now amended. With the amendment, the McCain-Feingold bill has ceased serving as a reform measure. It's now deformed. The American people should be outraged at this attempt by the U.S. Senate in the name of reform to allow even more money from wealthy interests into the political process. We strongly believe that the DeWine Amendment moves us backwards. For the vast majority of Americans who cannot afford to make $1,000 contributions, this amendment bill now makes matters worse.
Mm-hmm. Yet, Susan Anderson, it was passed 70 to 30. That's a lot of Democrats joining the Republicans.
That's true, and I think that is a very disturbing sign at how insular members of both parties have become about what represents reform. Reform is not something that is supposed to just make the system easier for people who are already in office. Reform is supposed to open up the system and create a playing field where all qualified candidates, regardless of their ability to raise vast sums, would have a competitive chance to run for office.
Susan Anderson, this study that you did, actually it was a few years ago, though it didn't get a tremendous amount of attention, The Color of Money, is a very important one in light of the kind of discussions we're hearing right now. It begins by saying people of color are largely absent from what has become one of the most crucial elements of the election process, namely campaign financing. What exactly did you find?
Well, what we did is we looked at every zip code in the United States, some 43,000. We looked at the federal campaign contributions that came from those zip codes. Then we looked at the demographics of those zip codes. Why we did this intense zip code by zip code analysis is that, you know, for good reasons, the Federal Election Commission does not ask donors to disclose their race when they're making a campaign contribution of $200 or more. But it certainly seemed evident to us that the campaign finance system as it is based now must be skewed towards a certain class of people, because our elected officials, certainly at the federal level, are not representative of what we see in the population. So in one example that we found in our study, that just one zip code, which I know is going to be very familiar to a number of your listeners there in New York City, the zip code 10021 in Manhattan on the east side, in the 1996 presidential election, contributed $9.3 million. There's only 107,000 people in that exclusive slice of Manhattan real estate. The vast majority of the residents in this zip code are white. To find a comparable zip code where residents of color comprised approximately 90% of the population, we looked at 483 zip codes where there were 9.5 million residents, and they contributed just a little bit over half of that amount, 5.5 million. Now, those are fairly large figures, and people have a bit of, you know, sometimes a little sense of getting their mind around that. But the average per capita contribution from that zip code in Manhattan was $86, whereas that average per capita contribution in those other 483 zip codes was 59 cents. This obviously shows how non-contributors, we feel, are excluded from a system. They're excluded because they're not able to help their candidates of choice run and win for office because of the smaller amount of funds they're able to make. And then incumbent lawmakers largely ignore people who are not making contributions because they hold no promise of financial support for the future election. This is just another reason why we feel that a more representative system could be had through full public funding of federal elections.
Stephanie Wilson, you're executive director of the Fannie Lou Hamer Project, where you talk about really campaign finance as a civil rights issue.
Right.
Explain that.
Well, oftentimes many people don't vote because they realize that voting often consists of a choice between candidates pre-selected by wealthy contributors. They realize that all Americans are not equal because a wealthy contributor has significantly more power than a voter does, and almost all contributors are white. Just as Susan was saying, about 95% of federal contributions reported come from whites. For every 100 people who contribute money in wealthier communities, which are less than 6% black, only one person, one person contributes in communities of color, which are over 70% black. These numbers, you know, they really shouldn't come as a surprise, since a typical black household earns slightly over half as much as the average white household. The mission of the Fannie Lou Hamer Project is to talk about campaign finance as a civil rights issue, how big money and politics disenfranchise African Americans, people, poor people, and we do a lot of education on this issue to galvanize support from communities of color on this issue for real reform, to get real reform.
Like what? Like what is it that you're calling for?
We are calling for public financing of elections. That's what we think will ultimately level the playing field, give everyone an equal opportunity to run for political office. For our system now, we believe that just like the poll tax, just like the literacy test, our current system is the new barrier for our people for equal and meaningful vote.
We've been talking with Stephanie Wilson, Executive Director of the Fannie Lou Hamer Project in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Stephanie, how can people get in touch with your group?
Two ways. You can visit us on our website at www.flhp.org, or you can call me directly at area code 616-349-9760.
And Sarah Anderson, the public campaign, Susan Anderson, the public campaign in D.C., how can people reach you?
People can reach us at our website, which is www.publiccampaign.org. That's public campaign, one word, one C. Or call us, our phone's there in Washington, at 202-293-0222.
So is the McCain-Feingold bill that was originally introduced, is it becoming unrecognizable?
I certainly don't think we've had a very auspicious opening to this debate. Senator Wellstone from Minnesota is going to try to start to right the ship, as we would say. He's going to be introducing an amendment within the next few days that which would allow states to have the right to choose public financing for their federal candidates for office if they so wanted to have such a system. If they were dismayed by how the current system operates, that it's based on the amount of money in your pocket, not the merit of your ideas, and if citizens of a state were so particularly disappointed in what was happening in this current system, that they could opt out and have their candidates run with public financing for federal office.
So it's a progressive Democrat who's going to be introducing a states' rights amendment.
Exactly. There's a little irony there. But, you know, if those people up in Congress feel that the states' rights are so important, then let's have it that way.
Well, I want to thank you again for being with us. And we're going to now go south to continue to talk about the marginalization of people. We're going to Mexico, where, as I said in the news headlines, Mexican President Vicente Fox has appealed to the Zapatista rebels to stay in Mexico City and negotiate with Congress over the proposed Indian rights bill. Fox also said he would meet the rebels' demands to close three more military bases near their headquarters and free more Zapatista prisoners. We're joined now by Tim Russo, who is the Mexico correspondent for Boulder, Colorado Community Radio, KGNU. He's been in Chiapas for the last 5 years and went on the Zapatista march to Mexico City, but has just returned to Chiapas, where actually he came home to a ransacked apartment. Tim Russo, what did you find?
Upon arriving back in San Cristobal in my house, we had had human rights people come by the house. We found that the house had been broken into, several locks sort of methodically taken out of the doors, and the wall painted with a slogan that says, effing foreign journalists. We look at this as an intimidation attempt, especially because of the involvement of myself and others in the inauguration and coverage that ChiapasIndieMedia.org was offering to the march and in Chiapas itself.
Explain that for a minute, the Indie Media site, the independent media center that you've set up in San Cristobal?
Yeah, just recently, actually, on the 9th of February, a collective of independent media peoples here in Chiapas inaugurated the webpage, chiapas.indymedia.org, and we launched that page just prior to the march of the Zapatistas to Mexico City as a key point to begin coverage in Chiapas. There's going to be quite a bit, and has been quite a bit, of participation by people from the communities in resistance, putting up their own video and audio, even written and photo productions.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves, but we're going to come back to you to get response to the Mexican president's appeal for the Zapatista rebels to stay in Mexico City. They say now that they're going to return to Chiapas. Tim Russo with us, Mexico correspondent in Chiapas. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Again, we're speaking with Tim Russo, who is the Mexico correspondent for Boulder, Colorado Community Radio, KGNU, in Chiapas. He just came back from the two-week march of the Zapatistas to Mexico City, where he found his apartment ransacked with obscenities aimed at foreign reporters scrawled across the wall. Mexican President Vicente Fox is asking the Zapatistas to say they say they're leaving, fed up with what Congress is doing with the proposed Indian rights bill. Can you explain what the state of affairs is right now, Tim Russo?
That's right. On the 19th, on Monday, the Zapatista delegation in Mexico City released a fairly harsh communique to foreign journalists and the public, saying that they would return to Chiapas after waiting for 7 days for some sort of positive response from President Fox and a positive response from the Congress to receive them in the Congress to be able to address the possibility for reinitiating the peace dialogue that's been stalled since 1996, with the main objective of pushing through the indigenous laws for indigenous culture and autonomy. To this point, until the Monday, there had been no positive response whatsoever by the Congress or by President Fox. And the sudden announcement to return to Mexico on Friday, day after tomorrow, seemed to put quite a bit of pressure on Fox to try and address those needs. You mentioned at the beginning of the show some of the demands that Fox yesterday came out with, saying that he was going to meet the dismantling of three military posts that remain and actually converting those into training centers for indigenous peoples within the conflict zone and within Chiapas. Also to release the remaining political prisoners, Zapatista political prisoners, that have been incarcerated since 1995. And a formal recommendation to the Congress to receive the Zapatista delegation and to begin to talk about how to begin the negotiation process. A fifth point that Fox said that he was asking for was a private meeting with the Zapatista delegation to talk about how to really push this dialogue forward.
Tim Russo, why is this former Coca-Cola executive, the current president of Mexico, Vicente Fox, so interested in the Indian rights bill right now?
Well, what we have to look at is that in this day of globalization, stability is really what is investor-friendly. Fox is a businessman, and what he's trying to do is really open the doors to foreign investment, show that there's a new democracy, that there's a Fox democracy, and there's potential for a tremendous amount of investment to take advantage of the 100 million people in Mexico and that workforce that represents. One of the main policies that Fox is trying to push through right now is the plan Puebla-Panama, which would essentially create a dry canal from the west coast to the east coast of Mexico in the southern states that would allow transport and the creation of new maquiladoras or export processing zones to be created. This would dramatically change the economic policies here in Mexico, open up lots of work, according to Fox, and really it hinges upon peace being established here in Chiapas and southern states.
Tim Russo, I want to thank you for being with us in San Cristobal right now, just returned from the two-week march of the Zapatistas to Mexico City. And you are listening to Democracy Now! The Zapatistas rose up on January 1st, 1994, the day that NAFTA went into effect. But this hasn't stopped other governments from trying to expand so-called free trade to the entire hemisphere. From April 20th to 22nd, Quebec City will host 34 heads of state for the Summit of the Americas. The central agenda item, passing the controversial Free Trade Agreement of the Americas, which would extend NAFTA to every country in the Western Hemisphere except Cuba. The trade pact has been the subject of secretive negotiations since the first summit was held in Miami in 1994, and negotiators have set 2005 as the deadline for implementation. Negotiators in Lima have already approved parts of a draft text. To keep protesters away from the action, police and other authorities have instituted sweeping security measures estimated at a cost of $30 million. They're raising a 10-foot-high, heavy-duty chain-link fence reinforced by steel posts and anchored in concrete that'll form a 2.5-mile security perimeter within the heart of the old town. More than 5,000 officers, including the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, are slated to work the summit, and the Canadian Army is presently training 800 riot police just outside Quebec City. Prisoners are being transferred from local jails to ensure there's plenty of room for protesters. But the activists have already encountered what has become the biggest security operation in Canadian history. In January, 10 New Yorkers en route to a meeting organized by the Summit of the Americas Welcoming Committee were denied entry into the country. Today, we're joined by a number of people to talk about the significance of the upcoming meeting, the plans for protest, and new trends in security and police activity, including the cross-border collaboration between security forces, or the globalization of security. Why don't we start off with Julie Carlson, who is co-director of the Urban Justice Center, is with us in the studio. You tried, Julie, to go up to Quebec City. What happened?
A group of 10 of us at the end of January were heading up to the meeting you spoke about earlier. We headed up the New York State Thruway and attempted to enter the Canadian, to enter Canada at the Champlain border, which is right off the Thruway. When we got to customs, they asked us to go to immigration. We pulled over, a group of us were in a van. We pulled over to immigration, went up to the counter, and they began asking us general questions like our name, where we were going, whether or not we'd been to Seattle, whether or not we'd ever been arrested. Or
is Seattle meaning the Battle of Seattle?
I'm assuming. That's what their intention was. And we answered those questions, and then they asked us to sit down and wait. At that point, we had given them our passports and identification. And then they began pulling us in individually to interview us privately. The first three people who were interviewed were denied entry into Canada. Two people were given the reasons that they weren't being allowed to enter because of misdemeanors that they had received 10 years ago. And another person apparently wasn't in the system. So because our friends were denied entry and we were all traveling together, de facto, we were all denied entry.
What kind of questions were you asked?
I actually wasn't interviewed personally, but they had it in the private interview, but they had asked folks about their political participation in activities and events.
Mm-hmm. We're also joined from Quebec City by Pierre Sigouin, who is Chief of Intelligence and Contraband Services for Canadian Customs. Can you tell us why these kinds of questions are being asked of people coming over the border right now, what you see as the threat?
Okay, well, we have to mention firstly that Canada Customs is responsible for the admissibility of the passengers, the travelers, and also verify the goods. And if we have any doubts concerning the admissibility of the travelers, those will be sent to the immigration, and the immigration department will finalize the admissibility of the travelers. That's the main part. You know, you have to mention that a lot of questions that I cannot answer because it's under the immigration regulations concerning why, but for instance, some people to come in Canada, they may, if they have a criminal record, they would be refused to come to enter in Canada. So things like that.
Is being part of political protest grounds for refusal?
Sorry, they had some noise.
Is being part of political protest grounds for refusal?
As far as Canada Customs is concerned, one thing that we have to inform the population that in Canada, it's a democracy country. All the customs inspectors are aware that a lot of people would come to Quebec to protest. Our goal is to identify the traveler that they would come in Quebec City with an intention, having a criminal intention. So the peaceful manifestors are welcome in Quebec City. But us, for security reasons, we have taken some training and awareness information session. First about concerning the organization of the summit, and also about customs formality to apply, and also, and thirdly, we have some information concerning certain group that they can be infiltrated by criminal people that they want to come in Canada to disturb public order or to commit criminal things. So Canada Customs, the main role is the security of the Canadian and also security of the travelers and the protection. So it's important for us to welcome the quiet people, the peaceful people, and also try to identify and intercept the one that would come with criminal intentions.
We also have on the line with us Max Scott of the New York People's Law Collective. What is your assessment of how Canadian Customs is dealing with protesters who are coming into Canada?
The Immigration Act, I used to be an immigration paralegal in Canada, and the Immigration Act, for better or for worse, allows fairly sweeping powers to an immigration officer. And unfortunately, the way to contest it involves a period of detention of 48 hours or more. Before you can actually go in front of an immigration adjudicator, which is like a judge, to actually contest whether they're denying you on reasonable grounds. In Windsor, when the Organization of American States met, about two out of every three protesters were turned back at the border, and a number were detained. And actually, eventually we beat the cases of everybody who was detained, and they were allowed to stay in the country. It's within the history of Canadian immigration to use their powers on very political grounds. I've seen them detain Tamils who were involved in, you know, peaceful protests in their home countries. I've seen them detain Iranians who had a history of communism but had never been involved in criminal acts. You know, there's every reason to believe that what they're trying to set up is a situation where they can deny people on sweeping grounds. And, I mean, we saw that with the 10 who were crossing. I went through the Immigration Act under Section 19. The actual records of the people who were denied were not grounds to be turned back. One misdemeanor is not grounds under the Act. It has to be the equivalent of an indictable charge in Canada, which is like a felony. You know, there's every reason to believe that they're going to use whatever means they can to stop people. I know there is a group that's planning to cross through Mohawk territory, where the Mohawks have said that they're going to open up their land allow activists across. And I know that people are going to have to be very careful about how they get across, because immigration is a very political body in Canada. Immigration, Ministry of Citizenship and Immigration in Canada is a very political body. And I've seen them use their powers politically, and I have every reason to believe that they will do it again this time.
Julie Carlson.
After we had expressed interest in going back to the U.S. After being denied entry, they held on to our passports and kept us detained at immigration for 2.5 hours, where they searched our vehicle against our consent, and also confiscated and photocopied some personal materials like journals and notebooks of talking about our, obviously, personal items, but also things having to do with organizing.
Pierre Segua, Chief of Intelligence and Contraband Services for the Canadian Customs. What is the explanation for that?
One thing that's important to mention, that for the travelers to come in Canada is not a right, it's a privilege. So, and they have to follow certain rules, certain procedures. And same thing for the Canadian when they would like to go to the States. We have to, it's not a right to go to the state. It's a privilege. So the immigration department at every country has developed their criteria to come. So,
but what are those rules? I mean, it sounds...
Unfortunately, I'm not the spokesperson for the immigration. I'm working for customs, and what I can talk is for customs. But we work closely, as I mentioned before, as soon as a customs inspector has a doubt, any doubts concerning the admissibility of the travelers, they would be referred to the immigration, and they would do all the process. That's the important thing. We know that for the summit, a lot of people would come from the States and also from other countries. So we have put in place a process that we try not to cause any delay at the borders. And also we have to identify the one that it would come with, as I mentioned before, with a criminal intention or to break any laws, Canadian regulations. So that's the, I would say, the main purpose of concerning the summit of the Americas.
The Czech Republic announced that they had received information from the FBI prior to the protests in Prague. In fact, the FBI set up an office in Prague for those WTO protests. Have you received information on American activists from the FBI here?
One thing we have to mention, we do have intelligence services into Canada Customs, and we do have a lot of contacts with other intelligence services in Canada and outside of Canada, and we do have regular contacts and with all their law enforcement into in Canada and out of Canada. You know, we're dealing with contraband, we're dealing with prohibited goods, and also we share information. So it's a fact that and it's known that all official services exchange information.
Uh-huh. So you have been working with the FBI.
FBI, and we do have contact with FBI through the U.S. Embassy in Ottawa, and also with we have do regular on a daily basis contact with U.S. Customs, U.S. Immigration.
Also, how about the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency?
As we don't have direct contact with them, as far as Canada Customs is concerned.
National Security Agency?
All organized agency, law enforcement, we do have contacts.
In the example that Julie Carlson just gave, after this group of activists were turned away, they still held them and photocopied journals, notebooks that they have. For what reason?
Unfortunately, you have to ask to the immigration spokesperson. I don't know what was their intention and what the reason, but what we've heard that two of them have the criminal record, and that's one of the reasons that they cannot come in Canada. They cannot have the access to come in Canada, and the third person has because no identification. The reason why and how, unfortunately, I cannot talk for them.
Mac Scott of the New York People's Law Collective.
You know, it's funny. It's interesting that the immigration, and even from what our officer here is saying, that they sometimes forget about the Charter of Rights and Freedoms in Canada, similar to the Bill of Rights here, which actually applies to everybody, regardless of citizenship. And though it may be a privilege to enter Canada, it's not a privilege to be put under the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which has grounds against unreasonable search and seizure. And even the Immigration Act states clearly that to conduct a more intensive search, like taking notebooks, photocopying stuff, the officer has to have reasonable grounds to believe that criminal activity will be going on when the person enters Canada. And in this case, the people had already stated that they wouldn't enter Canada. And I think also it's important to put this within the context of globalization, because I think, you know, we can debate law with customs all day if we wanted to, that as the goods and services of capital and the rich travel more easily across the Canadian-American border, across other borders, they're sealing the border against immigrants, they're sealing the borders against dissent, and you know, people are also organizing collectively against this, such as, you know, going through the Akwesasne Reserve on the 19th with the support of the Mohawks.
I actually want to ask the Chief of Intelligence and Contraband Services for Canadian Customs about that, about native land on the border. But we have to break for stations to identify themselves, and we are going to talk about the substance of what the protests are about in Quebec City with Mike Prokosh, coordinator of the Globalization Program at United for a Fair Economy. Our guest in the studio, Julie Carlson, co-director of the Urban Justice Center, Human Rights Project, and Max Scott with the New York People's Law Collective. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue our discussion of the FTAA protests that are taking place in Quebec City on April 20th to 22nd and look at the ways in which police and other authorities are mobilizing and instituting sweeping security measures estimated a cost of $30 million, again, raising the 10-foot-high heavy-duty chain-link fence reinforced by steel posts and anchored in concrete that'll form a 2.5-mile security perimeter within the heart of Old Town, Quebec City. More than 5,000 officers, including the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, slated to work the summit. The Canadian Army, presently training 800 riot police just outside Quebec City. Our guest, someone who's been turned away from the border as early as January, Julie Carlson, who is co-director of the Urban Justice Center with a group of activists who are going to make plans for the protests. Max Scott of New York People's Law Collective. Pierre Sigua is with us, Chief of Intelligence and Contraband Services for Canadian Customs, joining us from Quebec City. And on the telephone with us from Boston is Mike Prokosh, coordinator of the Globalization Project at United for a Fair Economy. Mike Prokosh, the overall take on, and I think a lot of people haven't heard about the FTAA, just exactly what it is.
It's the expansion of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, but it's not just a geographical expansion. It's not just an expansion from three countries, Canada, the United States, and Mexico, to 34, every country but Cuba in the Western Hemisphere. It's also an economic expansion. It's an expansion into new areas of the economy, and particularly public services, essential services like health, education, and water services. This is the new frontier for large capital, for large service corporations, and they want to use this new trade agreement to open up that market.
And how does it compare overall in terms of the World Trade Organization protests that we saw in Seattle, the kind of mobilization that we're seeing for this right now?
I think it's on a similar scale. Quebec organizers say that they have already 10,000 people who have called up and registered as coming to Quebec, and the Quebec Federation of Workers, which is 500,000 strong, is mobilizing for a peaceful protest on the 21st, on Saturday. At least on the scale that the AFL-CIO did for Seattle. So I think that it's about the same size. And it's also being preceded, by the way, by a much larger mobilization in Buenos Aires in Argentina on the 4th and 5th of April, when the trade ministers from around the hemisphere will meet to kind of put the finishing touches on a draft text, which they will then bring to Quebec. Estimates there are that 100,000 people will mobilize, and Argentina is in the middle of a huge political crisis right now because the government is being forced by popular pressure to reject an austerity program imposed by the International Monetary Fund. So That's going to be quite a scene.
It's interesting that the next meeting of the World Trade Organization is going to be in Qatar, a country that does not allow public protest. In Canada, I want to ask Pierre Sigua, again with Canadian Customs, if you are seeing more of a crackdown on protest with these international trade agreement meetings, like we saw in Windsor and now like we're seeing in Quebec City.
I didn't understand all your question. They had some.
Are we seeing an increase in sort of security crackdown around these international trade agreement meetings in Canada overall?
It's a fact, yes. You know what? After all, the incident occurred at the international meeting, so we have demanded. Hey, they asked us, and we. Receive, you know, we cannot compare Windsor with the Quebec City. Windsor, they had a meeting of the OAS meeting, and here in Quebec City will be, you know, it's a unique event, and it's the biggest event, receiving 34 head of states in Quebec City. You know, us in only Canada Customs, we have more than 33 customs port that the public in the Quebec region, so that the traveler may come to Quebec and to go to Quebec City. So it's a major event, and we have we work with other federal department and also provincial, and we have to do our mandate to receive and to process those people that would come to Quebec City.
Is it legal to use undercover agents in Canada?
Same as that's a police, the same as in American in the States and other countries.
Mm-hmm.
That's a investigation techniques.
Because we're also joined on the phone by Mara Verhaven Hilliard, who is an attorney with the Partnership for Civil Justice. And she was one of the group of attorneys who's been working in Washington, D.C., dealing with the A20 protests, the inauguration protests of George W. Bush. Talking about this issue of undercover agents and their role, you have just brought a lawsuit, Mara Verhaven Hilliard. Can you explain what that is?
We brought a lawsuit in advance of the inaugural demonstrations to try and ensure demonstrators' constitutional rights and access to the parade route and ability to express their First Amendment-protected views. And at the inauguration, we witnessed and had reports of really disturbing conduct by law enforcement authorities, both local and federal. So after that, we filed an amended complaint. And it deals in a large part with the use that we're seeing around the country of tactics by federal and local law enforcement to illegally disrupt and to criminalize lawful protest. We've seen it in Washington repeatedly at the IMF World Bank demonstrations and again at the inaugural and at other demonstrations around the country and globally. Here in D.C., at the inaugural, the Metropolitan Police and federal law enforcement authorities used undercover agents. Actually, on the parade route, there were agent provocateurs who came in and assaulted and pepper-sprayed lawful, peaceful demonstrators. There were agents who were infiltrating law-abiding and lawful organizing groups, simply surveilling and infiltrating people based on their political ideology, which we believe is extremely inappropriate. And further, the Metropolitan Police Department at the inauguration used their civil disturbance unit tactics to break up and disrupt groups of demonstrators who were seeking to assemble and express themselves, as well as at Freedom Plaza and at the inaugural parade site in particular. Federal and local law enforcement authorities actually gave law enforcement authority to the Presidential Inaugural Committee, which is a partisan political group.
Do any of these tactics sound familiar in terms of training of Canadian law enforcement, Pierre Sigua of Canadian Customs?
I would like to mention that Canada Customs, we do not do any undercover operation. We do have intelligence services, but we don't do any undercover things. So that's important to mention for us.
But that's just the case for customs, not for all.
That's the case for customs, the police, that they have their own operation.
I was also wondering if, just as we saw before Philadelphia, the Republican National Convention, Philadelphia police come up to New York and they were photographing protesters on May Day in New York, and you had all sorts of police officers from different cities going to the protests of other cities to observe and sometimes even to work. Were Canadian agents in the United States observing any of these protests?
I don't know. For us, we haven't sent anybody. We had only our people in Windsor, but Canada Customs hasn't not sent any people outside of Canada.
I would add, my understanding is that, in fact, the
Mara Verhaven Hilliard,
the Canadian authorities actually have imported our chief, Charles Ramsey, up to Canada so that presumably he can instruct them on these tactics he uses down here.
And can I also add, if you don't mind, there's also been a U.S. customs officer who is claiming to coordinate the intelligence operation on both sides of the border, who's been in contact with both Canadian activists in Kingston, American activists in Vermont and Buffalo, specifically around border stuff.
Finally, we're joined by Kate Sorensen, who has just been acquitted of 19 of 20 charges against her that led to $1 million bail being placed on her at the Philadelphia Republican National Convention. She's with Philadelphia ACT UP now, union organizing in Chicago. But can you tell us, as you listen to this conversation, about what happened to you? I mean, the fact that you were set with what shocked many, you as well as John Sellers of the Ruckus Society, $1 million bail, how that affected you, how they got you, how you were monitored in Philadelphia, and how almost every charge was dropped ultimately.
Well, this is a tactic that we're seeing from law enforcement as folks stand up against, the Republican agenda that's funded by corporate interests. They're giving false charges. They're giving high bail. The city of Philadelphia was willing to give me 20 years in prison and $1 million bail for what ended up to be $1,800 worth of damages that I had nothing to do with. You know, and they're willing to just do a breach on free speech and detain folks just because they believe that folks are going to have a nonviolent demonstration, and that's criminal.
How ultimately were you acquitted? What kind of evidence was presented?
I want to give kudos to law collectives that are growing across the country, like the People's Law Collective, because folks in Philadelphia pulled it together and pulled a whole collective of lawyers and folks that helped out all the people and even the folks that were given misdemeanors. We all stood in solidarity to help people who are given these crazy felony charges, and we just have worked for 7 months since August 1st to help all of us win, and there's still people, 10 people with felony charges left in the system that we're going to stand behind until they're out.
Kate Sorensen, do you see your case as having a chilling effect on other protesters as these protests go from one city to another, one country to another, to face what you faced?
Well, I think it's scary what law enforcement is trying to do, but I think that people are standing stronger and stronger because they see what's happening in the world. I'm really happy and impressed that people are taking a stand in the United States and taking responsibility for the FTAA and the WTO. I'm excited.
Mike Prokosh, as we end the program, coordinator of the Globalization Program at United for a Fair Economy, I want to ask you and Julie Carlson here in New York City how you are organizing people around the country for the Quebec City protests.
Well, in New England specifically, there is support being set up at various border crossings, legal support and moral support for people who intend to cross. There is a large convergence center being set up in Burlington, Vermont, as a media center, training center, legal support center for those intending to cross. And we are basically intending to put a spotlight on the border so that Canadian border authorities cannot deny people, even their rights under Canadian immigration law, and so that people aren't arbitrarily prevented from crossing. There are a large number of people intending to go. Unions are organizing very actively. There's a huge opening in the union movement right now in New England around globalization, and the unions are working very closely with community activists to mobilize.
Specifically, which unions in particular?
Industrial unions, but not only industrial unions. Unions that have primarily, of course, unions that have been affected by NAFTA and by the export of industrial jobs. So unions at General Electric plants, at other manufacturing facilities, International Union of Electrical Workers, Communication Workers of America, not necessarily the more progressive unions, but also service employees, unions, and so forth. So what's happening is that the news is getting out in the union movement that the effects of global trade agreements aren't limited to industrial workers, but are going to affect public sector and service workers as well. And that's a crucial step in the labor movement.
Julie Carlson.
Part of our work nationally is to connect with other groups who are doing work around the domestic impact of the globalization of economic restructuring. We're organizing lobby visits nationwide, as well as working to get folks a way to get up to Canada and to bring this back down home, and connecting all of that work together.
And if people want to get in touch with the Urban Justice Center and with the organizing that you're doing here in this area, where can they call?
People can call area code 646-602-5628, and can also visit our website at www.stopftaa.org/NY.
And Mike Prokosh of United for a Fair Economy in Boston.
Toll free, it's 1-877-JOIN-UFE, J-O-I-N-U-F-E. Our website is www.ufenet.org. And I would also recommend the Citizens Trade Campaign or Global Trade Watch website, which is www.tradewatch.org, which has nationwide information and especially information about fast-track trade legislation, which the Bush administration wants to get in order to rush the FTA eventually through Congress.
Finally, Pierre Sigua, Chief of Intelligence and Contraband Services for Canadian Customs. Are you concerned about squelching protest?
As a public servant, what we try is to give the best services, so not to cause long delays, any delays. And also, we have to protect, work the security, so manifestants are welcome in Canada, but we have to identify the one that would come with criminal intentions.
I think that it's clear that there's security that's being created to protect the interest of corporations, not the interest of the public at large.
For us, you know, we have a mandate. We have a public servant. We have a mandate to process. You know, we're dealing with every day with travelers and importation of goods. So we have a lot. We apply more than 60 law and regulation for the federal department. We have to try to stop any contraband drugs and things like that. So,
well, on that note, we have to wrap up the program. I want to thank you all for being with us. And again, you can go to webactive.com and you can see all the contact information. Also, if you miss the show, you can hear it online. That does it for the program. If you'd like to email us, mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Terry Allen and Chris Abrams, Anthony Sloan, our engineer, Errol Maitland, our technical director. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of you, our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
position is that